So we're exploring the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and I bet if we have a show of hands, because it's such a seasoned group, I bet there aren't many people who don't know what they are. Maybe everybody knows what they are, right? Does anybody not know what the Four Foundations are? Yeah. So in a certain sense, perhaps, but I was moved to do it, and I always learn stuff. So let's assume that's the journey here. And so last time we kind of talked about this, the preamble, you know, ardent, mindful, and fully aware, and what that means. And I just love that part. So today we're going to explore the first foundation. And it's so interesting and so helpful. I'm always amazed how helpful this first foundation is, because in our bodies, it often seems like the primary obstacle we're facing. And at the same time, it's like one of the greatest gifts to being mindful is how we work with our bodies. Because when we start out, you know, we kind of run into our bodies at every turn. They're uncomfortable. There's stuff we want. There's stuff we don't want. And it just seems really physical. But it's an asset, because this physicality of our bodies, it's when things get subtler, we get more into our minds and our states of minds, and then our memories start coming up, and all of these inner levels, then our body is like a huge gift, because it's just kind of steady. We can keep cultivating mindfulness of that to keep us from just spinning out on what's going on in our hearts and in our memories and our traumas and God knows what that we brought along from wherever. So I just kind of want to explore how it's an asset and kind of get into the six different aspects the Buddha taught in it, because we tend to focus just on breath when we think about it. But what he did was really rich. And he based his understanding, his sense of it, you know, in some ways on his own years of practice, seems to me, because he lived in body as a wandering ascetic in the Ganges Valley for many years before he became awakened. And then after, he wandered for another 40 years in the Ganges Valley. And during the pre-awakening time, he was just, you know, one more lean and dusty ascetic, half starved most of the time, being attacked by mosquitoes, insects, and certainly threatened by the occasional tiger. So it was a pretty physical and precarious kind of world that he strove in, his journey was in. And I'm sure you all know, but the Four Foundations, it's in the Satipatthana Sutta, number 10, in the Majjhima Nikaya. And if you look into there, as we do, we see that the mindfulness of body is broken into six subcategories, which are more than half of the 13 categories of mindfulness that the Buddha talks about. So it just really shows how important this is. And, you know, it's kind of a little bit like what Sean and Bruce are talking about. It's like we don't have to have a perfect conditions to do our practice, but it's just where we are. That's it. And the key is mindfulness. And how does that change our relationship, our insight to just how it is? And the body thing is so powerful, because we're really confused about our bodies. You know, we think it's us. And we get all kinds of aversions and attractions to other people because of that. It causes all kinds of problems. So the six aspects that he focuses on are breathing, postures, activities, anatomical parts, elements, and corpse and decay. Those are the six subsections of body. And if you think of them a certain way, that covers everything. I mean, what else? What other aspects of body weren't just mentioned? So the kind of a message is be mindful of everything. And it gets subtler in a certain way. those six, more, a little more abstract, not so much in our face moment by moment. Corpse and decay, we don't experience that because it will be a corpse for one thing. So it's more our understanding of it, and we don't encounter that many corpses usually, especially in the West. In Asia, you're more likely to encounter a corpse in various ways, from auto accidents to the burning ghats. But it's so powerful, you know, the more we really embrace this, it means that every moment is sacred, and every moment has this potential for insight. And every single thing we do, whether it's scratching my temple or whatever, has this potential to awaken right there, or to be a glimpse or a glimmering or an addition to our journey. So it's so amazing. And just back up for a second, how many people are aware of the three characteristics? I think that's pretty universal, pretty much, yep. So just for refresh, they are impermanence, not self, and dukkha, the kind of the three core characteristics of reality that we see through this insight practice. And it always usually starts with impermanence. That's what is the most obvious opening that comes up in practice. And as we develop more mindfulness of our body, it's impermanent on so many levels. I mean, there's this aging thing, there's this dying thing, and then all the motions and all the changes and imperfections and places where pains come and go, and the whole deal. So this is really a doorway to impermanence, just how we exist kind of as passengers in our bodies, and how we're mindful of what's going on with this odd vehicle that we seem to be in. And then also, you know, as we become more aware of this ever-changing aspect of things, and we look, keep paying attention and keep looking, this whole question of, you know, who am I and what does my awareness mean comes up over and over again. It becomes clearer and clearer that we're not our bodies. I mean, that becomes really clear. You know, the subtler aspects of, am I my consciousness? Am I consciousness? Am I perceptions? That gets a little harder to see, but the fact that we're not our bodies becomes pretty, pretty indelibly, irreversibly clear. And not self starts to emerge from that. And a lot of folks don't know that at all out in the world. They kind of think that they're bodies. That's, you know, I stub my toe. I mean, when someone says that, they can mean a lot of things. And we would say, I stubbed my toe too, but we don't think it's me. We just think, toe got stubbed. A lot of people seem to think it's them. And I know for Long Retreat, you know, you were, Sean and Bruce were just talking about these long retreats they've done, and perhaps, I don't know how many people have done pretty long retreats. I'm not trying to raise my hand, but encourage you to raise your hand. Yeah, quite a bunch. So, you know, in long retreats, it becomes really clear how fruitful this mindfulness of the body is, how kind of encompassing it is, because there's nothing much to do on long retreat but cultivate mindfulness, and it becomes clearer and clearer that the mindfulness practice we're doing is a lot bigger than just sitting cross-legged. It's like everything, you know, it's like a checklist, brushing teeth, be mindful, washing dishes, be mindful, dumping compost, be mindful, walk through the hall, be mindful, just like that. And in every case, there's some physicality going on. So it really helps remind us just how, in terms of our bodies, just this amazing place to cultivate mindfulness in this real simple core kind of landing kind of way. And it's all, you know, in this aspect of it, rooted in body. And so, you know, daily life, we can do that same thing. And I know many of us do. I'm preaching to the choir, but it's a good choir. And I know a lot of you have pretty consciously worked with your body in terms of mindfulness all the time. But just to keep remembering to do it and to get a little more, you know, that's the deal. Just keep dialing it up. So that's why exploring this was really helpful for me to explore this again. And maybe you too. In the mindfulness of breathing section, it's the first of the six, and the Buddha develops it with, you know, metaphors to help give a sense of how important it is. And we can get a little stuck there, but it's really, I think that's why it's so beautiful to take a look at all six aspects, because it helps us, you know, a lot of times practitioners, especially people that kind of come into this practice with some conditioning from other practices, and they feel real frustrated that they can't stay on their breath, and that they sort of have an idea that that's it, you know, staying on the breath is it. And they don't know yet about the insight part. They don't understand yet, well, the entire four foundations, but even all the aspects of body, you know, just to be mindful of whatever the thing is that's coming at you, that's manifesting. And as we all know, the difficult thing with practice isn't being mindful, but continuing to be mindful. And that's why breathing is so handy, so wonderful, because it has this quality, you know, of this rhythmic texture that we can pay attention to. There's nothing like it. You know, you can just kind of just land on the breath and watch it go up and down. And it gets subtler and subtler. If we get subtler, it gets subtler. That's crazy how that works. And it's just enough content to be mindful, but it's not beguiling content like our mental activities are beguiling. Breath has no content, nothing to get pulled into. So it's just this amazing tool to work with. So that's why it's important. And that's why returning to it again and again is so helpful. And I found, you know, it's particularly helpful to turn to the out-breath where it's falling away, because there's this exhale and then it just ends. And there's like nothing, like you just fell off a cliff. I find that really helpful to kind of see impermanence manifesting again and again. You don't even know if you're going to inhale again. And the Buddha says, talking about the different textures, this is breathing in long. He knows I breathe in long. Breathing out long. He knows I breathe out long. Breathing in short. He knows I breathe in short. Breathing out short. He knows I breathe out short. He trains thus, I shall breathe and experience in the whole body. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body. And I kind of love it. Just as, well, for one thing, just the way he articulates those distinctions of different kinds of breaths and whether it's in and whether it's out, that's really giving us some guidelines to really kind of be mindful of the whole mystery, the whole details, the flavors of it. And then I, you know, as many of you know, that the whole body is different interpretations about that. Does it mean the whole body of the breath, the whole arc of the breath, or does it mean your whole experience of your body? Because your whole body kind of moves when you're breathing, or both. You can choose your flavor, I guess. But we're experiencing the appearance and the rise and the disappearance. We're really feeling that. And that's where we start to see impermanence, you know, because it keeps falling away. It keeps falling away like everything falls away. And then something else appears, and then it falls away. And the more we can really just really kind of feel the texture of that. Steve Armstrong talks about touching the back, like caressing the back of your hand. It's almost like kind of texture, you know, just feeling the breath happen. And it's that great metaphor you're familiar with, but he talks about basically operating a lathe. He says, just as a skilled turner or his apprentice when making a long turn knows they make a long turn, or when making a short turn knows they make a short turn, so too breathing in long, he knows I breathe in long. And, you know, it's a wonderful image because of the lathe. Not that I get it. It's this very, very delicate thing where you have this sharp blade and you're just resting it on the wood, so you have to really feel it. You know, very delicate, not too much, not too little, just delicate, these shaving peels off. So it really is a metaphor to like help bring us into this sense of this gentle texture and this contact. It's pretty amazing. But maybe it's anything like that, you know, playing a viola or working a potter's wheel, all these places where it's simultaneously like a potter's wheel, you know, it's forceful and it's delicate at the same time. And you have to just touch it just right to make it work. I'm not a potter. My son is incredible. And I've watched him and he's talked about it a lot. And it's just extraordinary to watch how that works. So it's that really paying attention. It's just like that. But as we know, the Buddha didn't stop with breathing. It's kind of a place to just launch us into this whole exploration of body. And this list, like I said, it kind of goes from, gets more and more refined, more hidden, more stuff we might not notice. But all these things will lead to insight. So body postures. He's talking about how we're kind of being aware of how our body is in any moment. So it's really a message to us, you know, your body is sitting, be mindful of that. He says about posture, again, monks, when walking, he knows I am walking. When standing, he knows I am standing. When sitting, he knows I am sitting. When lying down, he knows I am lying down. And he knows accordingly, however his body is disposed. So isn't that beautiful? I mean, just, it's like a call to be, you know, if you're standing, waiting for the bus, to be mindful of standing. That's perfect. That's perfect. Just do it then. You climb the bus, you know, it gets into the motion part, but just whatever you're, however you're holding your body, whatever your body is doing, just to be mindful of it. It's so cool because it can, you know, like supercharge your practice because there's all these opportunities to be utilized. Don't have to be in a retreat. You can do that, you know, sitting at your workstation. Be mindful of sitting. Be mindful of your hand on the mouse. So it seems like because this comes right after breathing, you know, the Buddha is really encouraging us to spread our palate, to spread out. And it's also handy if you're in, even in a, you know, a sitting retreat practice or your own daily practice or something, and you lose track of your breathing, you can settle into your body and just be aware that you're sitting. And so it's not like losing the breathing is a problem. Just be aware of what you're aware of then. But, you know, especially when we're out there in the world, I mean, look what folks do, and we do it too, or I do it anyway. You know, we're looking around, looking at our phone, looking at what's interesting and attractive and reading signs and what's not attractive and who's attractive and who's not attractive and all this stuff, inwardly and outwardly, all this physicality. But we're not really aware of it. We're just ricocheting from all our interest or disinterest. So to be, just keep picking up on that and just keep returning to now. It's funny, I know so many people I know have been probably like yourselves, COVID ended, everyone went off to Europe or they went off somewhere and they're running around traveling and stuff, which is fine. It's all good. But there's a way in which it's all grasping after experience and trying to get, you know, nice experience. And from this point of view, it's really fascinating. I get puzzled by it. I don't even know how to think about it away. But it seems kind of pointless, kind of, from an ultimate sense anyway. And then the next step looks almost the same, but it's a difference. It's more an emphasis on motion. Like what your body is doing. And I found this really helpful in retreat because, you know, we're doing stuff. And the emotions we have, what our body does to cultivate mindfulness about those, it's just an option we have. We're going to do this stuff anyway. But it's really a way to just make the harness these opportunities for practice, just in, you know, what you do in the kitchen, what we do in the kitchen, what we do when we brush our teeth, all that, just broadening it out. It's pretty wonderful. The Buddha says, when looking ahead and looking away, he acts clearly knowing. When flexing and extending his limbs, he acts clearly knowing. I love that, clearly knowing. When wearing his robes and carrying his outer robe and bowl, he acts clearly knowing. When eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, he acts clearly knowing. You know, we could just try that for a minute. Just, you know, feel your right, your hand there, and then just move it, clearly knowing. Right? So it's just, we can always have that option to just keep bringing ourselves back to being aware. And there's little, you know, flashes of insight happen when we do that. We realize how everything's changing. We realize that's not really us. You know, this just keeps on peeling the onion. So we have this amazing opportunity with all these mundane things to keep on peeling the onion as opposed to being lost in it. You know, it's funny being in, I'm in Texas, right? And it's funny. It's almost in a weird way like New York City, because I often joke that in New York City, there's really nothing to do but eat out and have opinions. Because, you know, I mean, what do you do in Manhattan? You know, you walk down the street, you go to a restaurant and people talk. And here, because it's so hot, there's an incredible amount of retail opportunities. I'm flummoxed. I mean, there's malls and stores and glistening stuff everywhere and a zillion vehicles, and it's so hot, no one's walking. They just, I guess they're driving to eat stuff and buy things in stores. I mean, I'm sure they work, some of them, but it reminds me of New York in that way. And just the degree of, I won't say obsession, but people were, they're doing that stuff, they're purposefully doing all these things. And so it helps, it's sort of a lesson in how to keep cultivating mindfulness. I mean, I did drive to a store and ate something today, but I tried to be mindful of it. But it's pretty interesting what people will do. I get it. But we find freedom. That's the deal. Moment by moment, bit by bit, we get freer and freer. And all those things don't matter so much. And even life and death, as we were discussing earlier, they don't matter so much. Because we realize we're not the body, you know? So it's not exactly what we had planned if it's going to go away, but it's not quite the same drama. And remember that refrain we were talking about, and he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That too is how, in regard to the body, he abides contemplating the body. So it kind of keeps broadening that. Independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That incredibly simple statement that almost seems like, really, that's it? But it is it. You know? If we're not clinging to anything in the world, then we're free. So all these realms of contemplating body, just keep working at that. And it really, really, it just really helps expand and empower our practice the more we can really take this in. I've spent, you know, a certain amount of time in monasteries, and in a lot of ways, they're just like life itself. I mean, people, you know, some kind of food preparation happens. The monks don't do it. Anagarikas do, but nonetheless, people bring in food and someone's got to get in bowls and stuff. Depends on how the monastery is done. And people do some stuff, you know, if they're fully ordained, there's some things they can't do, they can't dig, whatever. But it's doing. There's a lot of doing that goes on in one way or another, whether it's just sweeping. And it's just like life itself. And it's really kind of helpful to remember, oh yeah, I'm sleeping here in my house. They're sleeping there and there. Same thing. Use it the same way. So it just keeps reminding us, you know, just cultivate moment by moment awareness. Do it with a sense of sacred possibility, just like we might in a monastic setting. And then the next three areas get just sort of grittier and more interesting. And I'm working on how to incorporate them in my practice. But this anatomical parts, elements, and corpse and decay. And they're so sort of startling that they don't get brought up that often in these kind of conversations. Because how do you work with that? And one of the really useful ones is this review of anatomical parts. I mean, it's this incredible exhaustive list of all these parts and systems of the body to be mindful of them. I find it really useful just in terms of, you know, the ways in which I'm hung up on bodies and notice, you know, I mean, I was at the gym today and was watching myself check people out, you know, and I get it. But to see through it also, we can do both, right? Like we're on the path. That's the whole idea. We're on the path. So it's okay if we find ourselves being hung up and then we see through it. But the anatomical parts thing is real powerful because it cuts through the ways in which we reflexively do it. And especially in our, you know, I mean, that's part of why people go to the gym is to look really good. And, you know, plastic surgery is kind of like buying new clothes in some cultures and on the world. And for a lot of people, it's pretty odd. And, you know, it's funny because we have this skin stuff, right, over our bodies. And it sort of seems like, oh, yes, that's this person like that. But the skin is so thin. And if you peel off the skin, like all of a sudden this beautiful person is, they're a mess with their skin peeled off or compromised or whatever. So it's just this sense of physicality is so ephemeral. It's just ridiculous, not to mention aging. But the body parts, you like this hilarious way that the Buddha does it. It's actually really powerful. He says, again, monks, he reviews the same body up from the soles of the feet and down from the top of the hair, enclosed by skin, as full as many kinds of impurity. Thus, in this body, there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, bowels, mesentery, contents of the stomach, feces. Well, that's awesome. Right? And to just bring that in, you know, just scan. I scan people a lot when I see myself getting diverted. I do that. I just scan people in my heart and just, okay, they're like a bag of rice with all these things in them. And he says, say that, as a matter of fact. He says, just as though there were a bag with an opening at both ends full of many sorts of grain, such as hill rice, red rice, beans, peas, millet, and white rice, and a man with good eyes were to open it and review it thus. This is hill rice. This is red rice. These are beans. These are peas. This is millet. This is white rice. So too, he reviews his same body. So it's a powerful, powerful thing. And we're not going to see all these internal organs unless we, you know, do an autopsy, which some monks in Southeast Asia, they do, as you probably know, they go witness autopsies as part of their training. Theravada monks do that. But just to do that, to use that tool in relationship to ourselves and in relationship to others, you know, mindfulness internally and externally, it's really powerful. And in a place like, you know, a place like Texas, it's kind of like Southern California. There's like a lot of very healthy-looking, beautiful persons of every gender you could imagine. But there's a lot of cultivation of appearance going on in a pretty intense way. And to be able to kind of keep looking through it, it's pretty amazing. And then the very last section, I'm still working on the elements, so I'm kind of skipping that for the sake of time, and I'll be interested if anyone else has a very strong thoughts. But the section on death and decay, you know, that's so interesting. I mean, it's kind of challenging because it's just our imagination. It's like this time, it's like this time-lapse photography of what happens when a body is basically thrown out of a burial ghat and left there. It's kind of what he's describing, things that used to happen in India and, you know, Tibet, South Sky Burial, where they cut up bodies and leave them out there for vultures, and Zoroastrians, I think, if I'm right, do something similar. So it's kind of, back at that time, there were a lot of bodies outside being taken apart and bones out there and burning ghat areas where some bodies were burnt and they had been burnt and here's the remains and all that kind of stuff. I've been in the ghats in Varanasi and seen bodies burning, and it's pretty intense, you know. They burn pretty briskly. But that part of, you know, to really, it's worth embracing this and checking it out and absorbing it into your view, kind of. It's worth thinking about ourselves, you know, put our body out in the field and just kind of visualize going through these steps, see how that changes our sense of ourself, or if we're attached to our youth, to whatever degree we are. I probably am, and I'm 74, you know. It's like, oh yeah, right? So to see through that and to review how it comes apart, it's pretty powerful. And he says, a skeleton with flesh and blood held together with sinews, a fleshless skeleton smeared with blood held together with sinews, a skeleton without flesh and blood held together with sinews, disconnected bones scattered in all directions, bones bleached white, the color of shells, bones heaped up more than a year old, bones rotten and crumbling to dust. And he says, this body too is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. So, you know, this is not our experience in the same way that the earlier ones are, in fact, our experience. But it is the reality. And almost bridging the business of the body parts and the bag full of rice and all the parts inside, and then getting to this, it just really helps not be stuck in all those ways. You can see impermanence, you can see not self. It's pretty amazing. So to, you know, get back to the beginning, the point of this whole thing is utilizing our bodies, a moment by moment awareness of body as doorways to awakening. All these different aspects at different times can be the very thing that cracks it open a little more for all of us. So to kind of have this wider palate, it's pretty amazing to have this wider palate. So yeah, breathing, great. You know, be mindful of breathing, but everything else too. And clearly there's nothing to be stuck to. Maybe just sit for a moment.